Ed, I think it may have been last time and the time before you asked who the heck is Gigi Bosatsu, and that got me started.
Oh boy.
And you helped me with ChatGPT and Google, and I did a little on Google. And it turned into kind of a bloodhound search with a lot of dead ends, and you know how bloodhounds work, sniff, sniff, and then nothing there, and go off in another direction. So anyway, I came up with some things that relate to the whole scripture of Avalokiteshvara. And so I'd like to talk about Gigi Bodhisattva in the context of the whole scripture. You probably remember when you asked this, I said that Gigi Bosatsu and Mujini Bosatsu are somewhat identical and represent Saint Everyman, is the way that her Master Ji put it. Anyone asking the question. And I discovered that there is one other place where Gigi Bodhisattva is mentioned in our liturgy, and that's in the funeral ceremony for an animal. At the very end, or it's an ordination ceremony or a funeral ceremony for an animal. And at the end it says, homage to Gigi Bodhisattva, homage to Kanzeon Bodhisattva. Homage to Gigi Bodhisattva, homage to Kanzeon Bodhisattva, homage to Gigi Bodhisattva, homage to Kanzeon Bodhisattva. And then this is what Reverend Master Jiyu had to say about Mujini. And then she put a footnote and said, I haven't been able to find out a thing about Gigi Bodhisattva. So the way that she translated it was homage to Mujini Bodhisattva, homage to Kanzeon Bodhisattva. And she says, but originally in the ceremony it said homage to Gigi. So this Bodhisattva, and she equates the two, is, if you like, the acme of the layman's perfection, always kind, thoughtful, considerate of his family, friends, enemies, and his fellow creatures of the animal world. He is ever seeking ways of making the lot of other creatures better. He is what we all can become, what we should aim at being. He is Kanzeon's right-hand man. Therefore, the priest calls his name during the ceremony for an animal. For if man will not help animals, who will? That was her way of putting it. I think both you and me didn't find much on the internet about Gigi, but I have a bunch of dictionaries of Sanskrit and Pali that I've accumulated over the years. And they say that Gigi Bodhisattva, and the Sanskrit name is Dharanim Dara or Dharanim Dara. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. And Mujini Bodhisattva is Akshayamati Bodhisattva. And so if you look at the scripture of Avalokiteshvara, the whole scripture centers around Mujini Bodhisattva asking why Kanzeon is given that name, and that Kanzeon means the one who hears the cries for help of the world, and by implication responds to those. So you can see there that the name of that Bodhisattva is important to the meaning of the scripture. And I started thinking, well, what about these other two? Perhaps the meaning of their names is equally of value to the meaning of the scripture. And so, starting at the beginning of the scripture with Mujini Bodhisattva, Akshaya Mati Bodhisattva. Kshaya means what falls apart or declines, what decays. And the at the beginning is a negative, so it's what doesn't decline or decay or fall apart. Mati means mind, and it also means the mind focused on something. So Akshaya Mati is the Bodhisattva who is focused on that which doesn't fall apart or decay or change. So I read that and think, well, this is the Bodhisattva, saint everyman, who is looking for what doesn't change because he or she is acutely aware of the koan of changeableness. So in a sense, when he asks what's the meaning of Avalokiteshvara's name, the Buddha says, to calls from every quarter, he responds. The oceanic depth is holy vows. He's talking about Mujini Bodhisattva's call for help and saying the Bodhisattva of compassion responds. And in that way, Mujini is representing not just his own koan, but asking that koan of everyone assembled there. What do we do about changeableness? What do we do about decline and decay and things falling apart? And then the Buddha goes into great detail about how Avalokiteshvara responds. I think it's also useful to remember that the Buddha here, the name of the Buddha, well, here he's called the one that the whole world honors, world honored one. But the name of the Buddha is the awakened one. So, world honored one, possessor of all grace, what reason is there for the Buddha's son, or the Buddha's heir, great Avalokiteshvara, the one who responds to the cries of the world, to be so addressed? The Honored One made answer too in verse, just listen to the life of Avalokiteshvara. To calls from every quarter, he responds. To calls from every quarter, this Bodhisattva is accessible. He responds to cries for help. The Buddha may seem a little daunting or remote to many. Avalokiteshvara is accessible. One of the popular names for the scripture of Avalokiteshvara is the Universal Gateway Scripture. So it's a gateway that's open to anyone and everyone. To calls from every quarter, he responds. Of oceanic depth, his holy vows, deep, profound, sincere vows to help all beings. And Kanzian is not a single human being. He's what any one of us can show through showing Buddha nature. Everyone has at heart that depth and sincerity. A myriad Buddhas has he truly served for ages past beyond the thought of man. So this isn't just something that cropped up this morning. It's something that goes way back, and there is a great sense of depth and thoroughness. Also, a thoroughness of experience, I would say, And also, this is showing the fact that this is something that goes beyond the human sphere. So actually, Avalokiteshvara represents or shows the unborn, and in particular, the compassionate aspect of the unborn. And Maitreya great vows of purity. When people hear his name and see his form and think of him not vainly in their hearts, all forms of ill in all the worlds shall cease. So you have both an introduction to what the Buddha is about to describe and also basically encompassing the whole of what he's about to describe. If you hear the Bodhisattva's name or see his form, what is that name? Well, it may simply be, you know, homage to Kanzayan, homage to Avalokiteshvara. Or it may be that silent sense of stillness that you hear in your heart that doesn't really have a name you can look up on Google. And the same with the form, it can be that formless light of compassion, or it may be any number of different figures that represent the Bodhisattva. So it's what works for you. And then Buddha goes into all of these different calamities. If wishing harm an enemy should try to push another in a fiery pit, the victim should on Kanzayan's great power think. What's that power? Just something that works. To look up, to think with the mind of faith and hope. Straightway that fiery pit should be transformed into a cool and silver lake. Well, really what that means isn't talking about externals, it's just talking about, oh, you can be at peace even with something that bad. And then goes through a bunch of others. The vast ocean's foam being thrown off the top of Mount Sumeru. Chased by wicked men, you fall down on a mountain, and so forth. All of these really, as I read it, are primarily talking about physical fear. Fear for your physical life. In whatever form it may come up, and these are a bunch of examples of calamities where someone was in dire straits and in fear for their life. When snakes and scorpions attack a man exhaling evil poisons, scorching him, has a double meaning. Snakes and scorpions tend to have an implication of hatred and lust. So when you find your mind or your physical being attacked or inflamed by lust and hatred, call on Kanzayan, find that place of peace. I want to make very clear here, this is not talking about something judgmental. It's talking about when you find yourself troubled and perturbed by these things. Call on Kanzayan. Lightning and thunder, heavy rain and hail storms, cruel disaster, interminable pain. All of these tend to be physical fear. He, being wise and full of mystic power, will save him from all worldly grief and care. With all miraculous powers well endowed. Well, what are all the miraculous powers? They're what works. You know, what works in a particular situation. It's not sort of a grand display. It's what works in this particular situation, in every particular situation. So, in terms of Avalokiteshvara being an example to us, It means when you find yourself in a difficult situation and you make an effort to be still, you can find that resource within you which helps you to respond in an appropriate way and in the right way, in a way that works both for you and for others. In all the world, in all the quarters, there is not a place where Canon does not go. And you could just as easily say there is no place where the Bodhisattva of compassion does not go, because also responds, but is present in all places. Hells, and so here it goes into what we call the cycle of samsara, or that wheel of suffering, the squeaky wheel of dukkha, as we were talking about. Hells, evil spirits, beastly creatures, all the evil ways of living, all the pain that comes from birth, old age, disease, and death, will for eternity all pass away. And what that's really showing is what you can come to understand when you have a first kinship. You can understand that there is that place that is a real refuge, no matter what happens. That in that place, you cannot fundamentally be harmed or thrown. Whatever you may feel like at the time, there is a sound place where you have a refuge. Great Kanzian views all the world in truth. He is free from defilement, loving, knowing all, full of compassion. He must always be prayed to, adored for all eternity. Adored, trusted, recognized as a help, valued. He is a light, pure, spotless, and like the sun, with wisdom does he darkness all dispel, subverting all effects of wind and fire, disturbance, change. His all-illuming light fills all the world. As thunder shakes the universe, does he control his loving body. The keeping of the precepts, that restraint of the beast of self. Sometimes it means, and you see this in writings or stories about Kanzian. Kanzian doesn't always have a sweet, pleasant voice. Sometimes it's the voice of thunder, saying, well, wait a minute, stop. You're headed in the wrong direction. So he controls his loving body and his thought of great compassion, like a cloud from which a rain of dharma comes as nectar down, destroys the flames of evil passions. Now, the thunder shaking the universe is controlling his own body, is that resolve to grasp the will, to make an effort to do something about suffering. That corresponds to when we talk about the flow of the breath, or the flow of the water of the spirit going up the spine and down the front. Thunder shakes the universe is that effort to climb the mountain that goes up the back. It's actually called the fire of the spirit as it rises up. And then the cloud of rain is the flowing down of the fountain of water of the spirit. So they're talking there about what we call the turning of the wheel, that full cycle of the breath rising up the back and coming in the third eye and then down the front into the heart as the water of the spirit. That's called turning the wheel of the Dharma. That's what the turning of the wheel of the Dharma means. Now, when threatened by court judgments or in camp, the military, should a man oppress, let him but think on Kamsayan's great power, and all his enemies will be dispersed. He has a most exquisite voice, a voice that encompasses all the world, the voice of Brahma, voice of oceans, one that excels all the voices of the world. So what are those voices of the world that it excels? It's the voice of the judge, the voice of the court judgments and of the accusatory lawyers, the judge of the dead, the way we judge and criticize ourselves. And it's the military barking orders. You know, these are the voices of the world. It's voices, again, that can throw you and throw you off balance or be painful to hear. And it's saying that the Kamsayan is a voice that excels all those, that can, in the midst of all of this torrent, give you peace. Let us never cherish thoughts of doubt about great Kamsayan. So, first of all, when we get to the court judgments and so forth and the exquisite voice, we move from fear of body to fear of speech. Okay, and then we turn right over again to the fear of mind, the fear of the thought. Let us never cherish thoughts of doubt about great Kamsayan. Because of this, our thought must always dwell upon him, the focus of the mind. So here again you have Mujini Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva whose mind is focused on the unchanging. Let us never cherish thoughts of doubt about great Kamsayan, who is all pure and holy and a refuge true, protecting in all grief and trouble, death, disaster. He possesses all merit, regards all things with a compassionate eye, and like the ocean holds within himself a mass of virtues inestimable. So here again is, even though we're talking about Kamsayan as a figure that can be relatable and accessible, it's showing here that it's much bigger than any one person or even any one human idea or ideal. It's the compassion of the cosmic Buddha. For this he must forever be adored. Then the Buddha stops talking and rose up from his seat, Jiji Bodhisattva. So, in Sanskrit, if you look at the name Jiji Bodhisattva, it's Dharanim Dara or Dharanim Dara. Dharanim or Dharani is earth. Dara is to hold. Now, in a literal translation, you have earth holder, Bodhisattva. Well, what's the implication of the earth there? Groundedness. That which underlies all our lives. And by the way, Dharma, which comes out of Dara, so derived from the word Dara, means, among other things, that which underlies, that which supports. So, earth also has an implication of that which is profoundly ancient. So again, that sense of long experience and thorough experience. Dara, to hold, means to uphold, to represent, and also to thoroughly understand. So, for example, the word Dharmadhara means someone who deeply and thoroughly understands the Dharma. Dharanim Dara, the one who deeply and thoroughly understands from long experience the value of being grounded. What does it mean to be grounded? It means to be practical, to be down to earth. It means to act from experience and from thorough experience. We talk about the Buddha walking, sitting, standing, lying down, something that we all do, and we do all of it on the earth. So we're talking here about being practical, so carrying over the teaching into the practicalities of our daily life. And that's what this bodhisattva represents, the one who thoroughly understands this scripture and is grounded and is affirming. So what does Jiji Bodhisattva say? They who this scripture hear of Kanseon Bosatsu must indeed no small amount of merit gain. For here his life of perfect action is described. This is the life of one who, all endowed with powers all miraculous, appears in all directions. A complete affirmation of what the Buddha has just said. He's the one who knows from experience that this works, that this teaching is valuable. They who hear this teaching must gain lots of merit. Why? Because you can learn how to put these things into practice. What is merit? That it's positive activity. Merit is positive karma. Karma is activity. So he's the one who knows that you can put these things into practice and that they work. And that even within your own life, in your own small person, you can find that which shows the life of perfect action is something we can work towards and we can learn how to do. The life of one who, all endowed with powers, all miraculous, the Buddha nature is a profound resource, appears in all directions. Again, you can see it wherever you look, you can see it in everyone that you look at, you can see it in yourself, you can see it in everything that happens. And again, that doesn't mean it will be easy, but there is that which you can do when you find yourself thrown or disturbed and make that effort to be as still as you can be so that you don't go off into sort of blind reactions to whatever has happened. So, this is my own thought. I haven't read this anywhere in any scripture. But when you think about Ujjayini as the bodhisattva whose mind is focused on understanding the unchanging, the Buddha, the awakening and awakened one, explaining the life of Avalokiteshvara is the life of compassion. And then Jiji Bosatsu as showing how to put that teaching of compassion into practice through being grounded and practical. I think you have here a direct and probably intentional parallel to certain aspects of the life of the Buddha before he became the Buddha. So he's the prince and he's living in this palace where everything's fine all the time, so they say. And he has this great wish to leave the palace and go out and see his constituents, you know, who he's supposed to be destined to become the king of. He wants to see his people. And so he goes out with his charioteer, and what does he see? We talk about the four sights. An aging person, a person who's terribly sick, a person who has died. And in each case, the Buddha sees these and turns to Chan and says, what's that? Well, that's an old person. Well, we'll all get old. That's a sick person. Sooner or later, we're all going to get really sick. And that's a dead person. Sooner or later, we all will die. And the Buddha's response to that is a great compassionate sadness. And then he sees a monk and recognizes there's hope. This doesn't have to go on forever and ever. There's something you can do about it. And so, as I read this, in this case, the monk he sees represents Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. And for him, that meant leaving the world, leaving his family, and becoming a monk. But that was him. Everybody doesn't have to become a monk in order to understand compassion or to see compassion in the things that you see in the suffering of the world. The Buddha did. And so you have, first of all, those foresights, right? He sees suffering and he decides, oh, there's something I can do about this. And then he sets out doing it. And for 6 years, it said, he went about learning how to meditate, learning how to train, tried asceticism, it didn't work. But he tried it as far as he could. So he was basically learning how to grasp his will, and then discovered that there has to be more to training than just will. There also has to be faith. And that's where he found that sense inside of the middle way, and that sense of what he needed to do was to meditate. As he had discovered when he was a child, he discovered how to meditate as a child and realized he had to come back to that. So he resolves that that is the willpower he will use. He will meditate as deeply as he can and will remain in meditation until he finds the resolution to this koan of suffering. And what happens? He's immediately attacked by the army of Mara. Well, what's the army of Mara but all of these calamities of physical fear, fear of voices, fear of the mind? That's the army of Mara. And so what's he do as the army of Mara attacks? He touches the earth. He witnesses the earth. So you have Jiji Bosatsu as the representative of the earth, of groundedness. And then, after that, he goes into deeper and deeper meditation, begins to understand the training from his previous lives, and goes on from that. I think that the scripture of Avalokiteshvara represents the life of the Buddha. And sometimes it is said of the Prince Gautama, before he became the Buddha, was the embodiment of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. But it represents, what do you do about suffering? And then, how do you go on? So, you touch the earth, you ground yourself, and you go on. And so the last part of the scripture, when the Buddha thus finished the recitation in the hall of this great scripture, all people present then, all those who had heard it, cherished a deep longing for the supreme enlightenment, which nothing in all the universe compares. So again, it's like the life story of the Buddha. After the attack of Mara, after grounding himself, he went deeper and deeper into meditation. And then with the dawn and the morning star, he recognized deeply and thoroughly the unborn.
Recognized what?
The unborn, that which is unchanging, undying. And so in a way, it cycles back again to the mind that seeks the way. All these people hearing this scripture, resolve to find that enlightenment, the mind that looks for that which is unchanging and undying. So it's a parallel there with the word called the bodhicitta, which is the mind that seeks the way, but it's also fits very well with Mujjini Bodhisattva, has the intent on finding that which is unchanging.
Emptiness.
Yeah. Emptiness of self, immaculacy. Yeah, exactly. And as we recite the scripture in the morning, then what do we do? The next thing is the scripture of great wisdom, which talks about Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, knowing that the five skandhas, the self, is in its self nature void, unstained, and pure. So we go from that, finding out what we can do about suffering, into finding that which is unchanging, undying. And so, in one version of the scripture, knew that the skandhas five were void, unstained, and pure, and took all suffering across to the other shore. And that's as far as I'm going to go for this morning.
That's pretty amazing. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There's a lot there.
Yeah, those two names that I'm sure in the beginning, when this scripture was first used, the names of those three bodhisattvas were well understood, the implications of those three names. And somehow in the course of translation it got lost. But it's still there in the teaching that we do, but it's all right there in the scripture as well. It was fun.
It sounds right on, yeah.
Yeah, that was a lot of bloodhound work, and then sitting with what all the dictionaries said. What are they actually trying to say with all of this and with all of these fancy words? You don't have to know Sanskrit to understand how to train with compassion. But sometimes it helps to sort of clarify this or that.
But Jiji Bosatsu was there in the hall,
yeah.
So he was a guide.
Right.
Basically, they're listening to Gautama.
Yeah, he was another example of Saint Everyman.
Of what?
Saint Everyman. One of the people who was listening. Everyman. Saint anybody.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And someone who clearly, from his name, had a fair bit of experience with training and knew how to, you know, keep grounded with it. So he was able to affirm and praise what the Buddha had said and say, hey folks, this works.
Yeah, thank you very much for going over that. I have a greater understanding of what that means now.
You're
I really
welcome.
Appreciate your work.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I found myself being confronted with it all this past couple of weeks and just things that have been happening. You know, I go, oh,
yeah.
That's what it means to respond to calls from every quarter.
Right.
Yikes! You know, that's the thing. When you make those vows, the Bodhisattva vows, the Eternal says, here, try this. You say you want to help beings? Here. Here's some help that's needed. And that applies to, you know, any one of you who say the Kesa verse in the morning. I wish to unfold the Buddha's teachings so I may help all living things. Having that intention of helping, and as Master Jiva said, also helping your enemies. Sometimes helping your enemies means getting out of their way so they don't have the opportunity to make more bad karma for themselves.
Yeah, interesting to see the parallel between the scripture and the life of the Buddha.
Yeah.
That's something that never crossed my mind.
Never crossed mine until I started thinking, wait a minute, you know, the four sides, this sounds familiar. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And I, I'm not enough of a scholar, and I'm not sure anybody is at this point, but I'd be willing to bet that was conscious, they were consciously aware of that when they first started using the scripture. And just, you know, because especially as you go back into Indian Buddhism, everything refers back to the life of the Buddha. Even, you know, the scripture of great wisdom and the larger versions of it, all the illustrations illustrating what great wisdom is, show episodes from the life of the Buddha. So, that's my guess.
Well, when you put it that way, it seems likely. It just had never dawned on me.
Yeah. And that's really the importance of the both of this scripture and of the life story of the Buddhas. How can you relate these things to your own life, you know, because you're a Buddha. That's another thing that comes out in the first part, in the prose part of the scripture of Avalokiteshvara. It talks about some of the calamities that may arise or the fears that may arise, and it's pretty clear from those that they're alluding to stories, Jataka stories, of the Buddha in previous lives. So, there again, you know, how does this relate to each of us, to things that happen to us?
They know his previous lives.
The Buddha?
Yeah.
Did he?
No, do they know of his previous embodiments?
Yeah, there's a whole scripture of something like 500 of the previous lives of the Buddha.
Wow.
It's called the Jataka stories. And there are a whole different bunch of variety of versions of it. The Mahayana version is a little different than the Theravadan version. But they pretty much agree.
With names and everything?
Sometimes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. I think I've related a few of those to you from time to time. I probably will continue to do. I find them quite interesting. There's a book called Once the Buddha Was a Monkey, and one of the stories is about a life, previous life of the Buddha, where he was born as a monkey.
Okay.
Others where he was a hermit or a king or, you know, all sorts of, basically it's the story of all sorts of different people. And that's, I think, the point of it, you know. Everyone has that potential to become Buddha.
Oh. Yeah. That's good.
Jataka. Jataka means... Jat is birth, and Jataka means birth stories, stories of the Buddha's previous births.
Do you make mistakes?
Well, these stories tend to be fairly idealized.
I see.
But I think there is one that tells where he was. He always tends to be the leader, and in one of them, he's the leader of a band of thieves.
Oh.
I have to go back and look at that, but I'm pretty sure that is one of them. So,
and we learn from our mistakes.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We have to make mistakes so that we learn from
other stories from the Buddhist life. He talks about having headaches and says, well, in a previous life I did something I shouldn't have done, and so now I have headaches. And then when he was dying, he said that the reason I'm dying of dysentery is because in a previous life I was a doctor who gave the wrong medicine and caused someone to become ill and die. So he was cognizant of his previous lives and talked about it.
But he did die of dysentery?
Yeah. Probably, well, yeah. Well, it was dysentery, but he was given a, this is an interesting story of itself. Well, I'll go ahead and digress if you don't mind. Do you remember the name of the person who gave him the gift?
I don't.
Okay. It's eluding me right now, but anyway, there was a lay person who invited the Buddha and all of his disciples to come for a feast. And one of the foods that he offered to the Buddha said, I'll partake of this food and I'll accept it and eat it, but don't give it to anybody else. Bury the rest of it. And then he got sick from that, and that's what he died from. But before he died, he said, be sure, he told his principal chaplain, Ananda, be sure and tell this person who gave us the food that he should not feel that he's done something wrong in giving me this food, because this is the food that allows me to enter parinirvana. And so in that way, it's the same as the food that was offered to him that led to his enlightenment.
Oh, I never drew that parallel before either.
Yeah, I think that's right there in the scripture. So he wanted to make sure that Kunda was his name, understood that he hadn't done something wrong. But he did make sure that nobody else ate that, because he didn't want his whole Sangha to die.
Stop Buddhism in its tracks.
He had some foresight there. And he had known well in advance that he would die soon. And so during that period of 4 months or so, he traveled to all the places where he had taught and reviewed his teachings with everyone.
He was sick for 4 months?
No, he just knew that he would die. I don't know how long he was sick for, but it wasn't very long. And then after, even after becoming sick, he did continue traveling on by foot until he found the place where he lay down and said that he wouldn't rise again. And then as on his deathbed, continued to offer teaching. And in the Mahayana version, that's been expanded into the Mahayana Parinirvana scripture. And in the Theravada or Pali version, it's much shorter, but he reviews all of his teaching and then says, I've given you everything that I can, and now it's time for me to die, to enter Parinirvana. Okay, well, enjoy your April morning or afternoon.
Thank you,
Reverend.
Yeah, thanks for your work you put in on that.
I enjoyed it.